This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. How you doing this Halloween? Oops.
Yeah, just so you know, you've got kind of lousy acoustics there, Nate.
Dang it. How about now?
Okay.
Let's try this. Checking 1, 2, 3.
That sounds okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, how are you doing this Halloween evening, Dr. Lyle?
Good. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, not out with the kids trick-or-treating, not doing anything like that. I'm here at the show, and that's exactly where I want to be. Because it turns out we've got a cool topics today. Facial cues and how people can read certain personality traits based on people's facial cues. A couple of questions about personality. And then a couple of questions about non-food potential pleasure traps, like casual mating and masturbation. So all in the mix for today's show. We have the facial cues. New research shows that people can predict something about a politician's honesty just by looking at them. But it's not the lips that they're noticing, or the eyes, or the ears. A series of studies conducted by Caltech researchers show that when people are shown photos of politicians they're not familiar with, they can make better-than-chance judgments about whether those politicians have been convicted of corruption. People can make these judgments even without knowing anything about the politicians or their careers. And one thing they seem to be picking up on is how wide the politicians' faces are. The new Caltech study is the first to show that observers have a knack for picking out corrupt politicians based on just a portrait, and that observers perceive politicians with wider faces as more corruptible. It's important to note that the researchers are not claiming that politicians who look corruptible are inherently more corrupt than those who look honest. Their research simply shows a connection between facial appearance and corruption, but they say there could be many explanations. One possibility is that if a face conveys a sense of dishonesty, the politician might be offered more bribes more often. Another possibility is that the corruptible-looking politicians are not any more corruptible than honest-looking politicians. But because of their looks, they are more often suspected of, investigated for, and convicted of corruption.
A study which appeared in the
Journal of Psychological Science consisted of four parts. Part 1. The researchers collected pictures of 72 politicians who held office at the state or federal level. Half had been convicted of corruption, and half had clean records. All of the politicians included were male and Caucasian. All of the photos were black and white, cropped to the same size, and featured a frontal smiling portrait. The images were presented randomly to 100 volunteers who were asked to rate each politician on how corruptible, dishonest, selfish, trustworthy, and generous they looked. An analysis of the data collected showed that the volunteers as a group were able to correctly differentiate the corrupt politicians from the clean politicians nearly 70% of the time based on their faces alone. Part 2 of the study. The second part replicated Part 1, but used photos of 80 politicians elected to state and local offices in California. Half of them had violated the California Political Reform Act, a law that regulates campaign finance, lobbying, and politicians' conflict of interest. And half had clean records. As before, the data showed that the volunteers could correctly differentiate the corrupt politicians from the clean politicians nearly 70% of the time. Part 3. The third part of the study used the images from part one, but then asked the volunteers to judge the politicians on a new set of criteria: corruptibility, aggressiveness, masculinity, competence, and ambitiousness. The data from this study showed that only corruptibility-related trait inferences differentiated corrupt politicians from the clean politicians. However, inferences of competence, ambitiousness, or masculinity did not predict the politicians' records. Part four.
Okay.
In the fourth section of the study, the researchers examined which of the politicians' facial structures the volunteers associated with dishonesty and corruption. The faces were characterized by eight measurements that described things like distance between the eyes, size of the cheekbones, nose length, and face width. By comparing the data from those measures against the judgments made by the volunteers and the records of corruption convictions, the researchers found that politicians with higher facial width ratios were more likely to be perceived as corruptible. The second part of Part 4. To double-check that the face width was truly the characteristic driving negative perceptions about a given politician, the researchers gathered photos of 150 politicians and then digitally manipulated each into a wider-faced version and a narrow-faced version.
Yeah.
The 450 resulting photos, including the 150 unaltered originals, were shown to 100 participants who were then asked, as in the previous studies, to rate each image according to how corruptible the politician seemed. And again, face width made the difference. The volunteers judged the wide-faced versions of the politicians to be more corruptible than their thin-faced counterparts. The study, titled Inferring Whether Officials Are Corruptible from Looking at Their Faces, was published in Psychological Science on September 12th. The authors are Chu Jun Lin, Ralph Adolphs, and Michael Alvarez.
Fascinating. I'm not sure I heard in there that they actually ran any correlation coefficients on corrupt politicians versus a random sample of non-convicted politicians, and looked specifically for whether or not, as a group, the corrupted or the convicted politicians literally had wider faces. So I'm hearing that people suspect that that's true. There's some correlation there, perhaps, but I'm not sure how strong the correlation is. So I'd have to really look and see what all is in their data and what can be inferred from it. But that is, it sounds like what they've found is that people are picking up and cueing on the face width, and that there is truth in it, is what I'm hearing. I think that's what I'm getting from those studies. I believe that's true. Is that what they're saying in the discussions, or what's the conclusion in the discussions that you can, do you know anymore?
Yeah, unfortunately, the study is behind a paywall. So,
right.
I'm emailing the lead author.
Yeah.
Because I know lead authors are allowed to give you the full, you know, part.
Right.
So perhaps we can get that full and have another show where we talk. So come on, me.
No worries.
Article.
you're having acoustical problems again. Just by the way.
Ah, dang it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, now suddenly they're better.
Well.
Okay.
Maybe.
Well, anyway, that's very interesting. That's heck of interesting. It surprises me that it's not, that it appears to not be correlated directly with. I'm not sure what we can infer from this, because it's a little bit. Sometimes these studies are tricky, and to really figure out what we've discovered is a little hard to do. But it sounds like there are characteristics that people are making inferences about. So by looking at, for example, a whiter face, which may be a more testosteronized face, that people can tell the difference between cues that indicate ambition and cues that indicate dishonesty. That, and if that's true, particularly at the level that appears to be the case there, 70%, when 50-50 is the coin flip, that's almost unbelievable from looking at – I mean, I'm actually astounded at this evidence, folks, just as somebody that stared at an awful lot of data in psychology experiments. This is a spectacular effect size. And if it is what I think it is, it's showing us that you can tell there are going to be cues in the way a person's face is built that and probably we're picking up hormonal issues, you know, that drove the entire orchestration of the face as opposed to other variables that could have done it, other genetic variables. So what we're seeing is that probably hormone levels in faces, and it's very likely to be the case in females as well as males, is going to enable us to make some pretty striking and remarkably accurate inferences about their personalities. So I want to see more of this type of thing, and I'm sure that these guys are not out there all by themselves, and they didn't just come up with this out of the blue sky. In other words, somebody else has been doing similar things. So this is all fascinating stuff, and this is the brave new world as people from Caltech start to get interested in things like this, and now we're going to get some good science. All right.
This is fascinating.
Yeah
it's fascinating that that people may be able to tell your personality. Social science may have no explored detail.
Drat, I want to hear what you're saying, but you're breaking up. The fact that there may be quite striking correlation coefficients in social processes, social psychological processes, personality issues that are discernible from vision, just about how a person's facial characteristics are built, much less the rest of them. I mean, that is, I sit back and wait for a new wave of data and investigations that could be remarkably illuminating as it tells the story of individual differences at a level of illumination that I wouldn't have necessarily thought was possible, just by looking. As who was it was, what is Yogi Berra? You could tell a lot just by watching. You could see a lot. You could observe a lot just by watching. this may have a deeper truth than we knew. All right. Very good.
It's fascinating,
Nate.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes, I sure can.
Okay. Yeah, it's fascinating that someday we might understand this in greater detail, and that you can tell someone's personality or parts of their personality just by looking at them. It seems like social science will have nowhere to hide after all these are figured out in more detail.
Yeah, i.e. learning theory, psychodynamic theory, et cetera, a lot of dead theories theories of individual differences that have not been appropriately buried are going to get buried by this. So this is, that's fascinating. I mean, I have believed, I think I've known about some of these things. I've known about, I think, facial characteristics and aggression. That doesn't surprise me any. I think there's testosterone cues that you're going to expect people with certain configurations to be more likely to interrupt you, to be more essentially more pushy and aggressive, and so on and so forth. That wouldn't surprise me. You know, that doesn't surprise me at all. But this is now going deep and subtle in something that I wouldn't have imagined that the human mind would have a chip for it, and it appears that there is. That's amazing. So hey, we stand by ready for the next surprise. Very cool.
Just another reason to lose weight if you've got too wide of a face as well. But that's just. Just kidding.
Okay, very good. All right.
Okay, so our question is actually about cues too. Our first question from a listener is, Dr. Lyle, since you've introduced me to the Big Five, I've been constantly playing Guess the Personality game with everyone that I come across.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but include facial features and hormonal cues and the like in my judgment. Am I right to? Are there shades of truth to things like phrenology?
Well, not to phrenology. So phrenology was a concept introduced to the world in the 1800s by a pair of guys by the name of Gall and Spurzheim, and they had this elaborate scheme of the bumps on the skull, and they thought that they could tell people's personalities by looking at their skulls, Fair enough. I mean, it was a good try, but there's like no truth in it. I think the only truth that you're going to see is that probably bigger skulls house bigger brains, and therefore there's a tiny correlation coefficient between the size of a person's skull and their intelligence. Not much, by the way. It turns out that correlation coefficient may be so small it would be below the ability of people to detect it. It turns out that the size of the person's brain, however, sitting in the skull, correlates quite well with their intelligence level. So these are things that wouldn't be observable. And phrenology was a ludicrous idea that the sort of bumps on the skull corresponded to different personality characteristics. So, I mean, it was all very cool. But all silly. I actually have in my personal library, I have one of the original works on phrenology by, I think it's either Gall or Spurzheim. I got a, you know, if anybody wants to give me a bunch of money for it, I would sell it. I think I got it as a gift when I got my PhD. But this person's question is obviously relates to exactly what we were just looking at. And this Caltech study is a new look at the analysis of this. These guys are getting very sophisticated. And I do believe that you're going to find hormonal cues in people's facial configurations that are going to tell us a lot. Just from my own standpoint, just when I look at people, I'm pretty sure that the correlations are strong enough just by looking at testosterone and estrogen cues. But I believe that I can predict far better than chance whether or not a person is going to be assertive versus more passive. And I could be wrong. In other words, it could be that I'm taking into consideration a whole bunch of other things that I'm seeing with the person, their body posture, movement, facial expression, the way they dress, everything about them. You're computing a whole bunch of stuff when you look at people. You're looking at their whole social context. Who are they with? What does it look like? Who's controlling the conversation? You know, their height, their build. There's just a slew of stuff that, as Tubian Cosmides pointed out a long time ago, you could have people, males that are mesomorphic, and they are much more likely to be in prison, not necessarily because the testosterone drives more aggression, but rather that the mesomorphic situation leads them to be more often in social situations where their muscles will enable them to aggressively get what they want. So all things being equal, more muscular men are likely to be more assertive and actually to use that aggression. And so you might say, well, that's not true of my cousin who has a PhD in astrophysics from MIT, and he's a big, strong guy. Yeah. He's also got all kinds of conscientiousness and IQ, and he's not going to use that. He doesn't need to use that to deal with the disputes that he deals with. However, let's make him 90 IQ and make him a high school dropout, and let's have him working at the car wash. Now we're going to find out if there's a dispute over who used the wrong rag, whether or not, you know, he's more likely to wind up in fisticuffs. And the answer is going to be obviously yes. He's going to be a heck of a lot more likely than someone who's built thin and slight. So, and obviously as a male, he's massively more likely to wind up in a physical confrontation than a female. So, yeah, I believe the answer to the question is yes. And I think we're going to find these things in a lot of different places and a lot of different ratios in the face. Possibly we might even, I think the length of the jawline, for example, there's going to be all kinds of things that you're going to pick up. Probably a very short jawline in females, and wide lips and so forth, and arched eyebrows are going to be indicative of high estrogen levels, and that's going to probably result in people that are less assertive. And so all of this, this is all then confounded by how just physically attractive people are, because physically attractive people tend to be more assertive. This winds up being pretty spectacular and subtle and involve a lot of dimensions that get fed into this. And so that's why this Caltech study to me is so fascinating. Had they said that the results were 55-45, I would have said pretty good, not by chance. It shows us that there's something there. Had it been 60-40, I would have said, wow, that's a big deal. That's such a big deal that if you're a politician with a wide face in that dimension, you're working against a public that can sniff out that you've got a correlate there that indicates that you're much more likely to be dishonest. Okay, the fact that they could pick them out 70-30 to me is unbelievable. So it borders on not believing it, but just the way that you've told the story and who did this research and the meticulous nature that they went in and the fact that they replicated the same levels in two samples. I mean, that is just, I can't tell people that are listening, you know, someone who, you know, did many psychological experiments and ran a lot of data and never got anything out of it because I didn't have any good evolutionary hypotheses. So, you know, I watched more than one laboratory at the University of Virginia in social science just flounder around with a bunch of garbage in, garbage out for data because we could never find anything true, and we ran the studies properly, so everything appropriately came back like just a random scatter plot, okay? If we had ever had anything that had a correlation coefficient that high, we would have, you know, we would have crowned ourselves king. That's a thing of beauty. So, yeah, I think the answer to the question is it's just beginning. And now we've just waved the red flag in front of the bull, and we got some pretty sophisticated people now realizing that they're going to be able to grind away at the mysteries of human nature with some really hardcore science, and that's beautiful.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now we're going to turn the ship around a little bit, and instead of talking about the facial cues and personality,
yeah,
we're going to start talking about non-food potential pleasure traps.
All right.
The first one's about casual mating. So, Dr.
Yeah.
Lyle, my very pretty mid-30s female friend wants to find a pair bond and have kids.
Mm-hmm.
But she keeps falling for casual mating guys and admits that she can't resist that they have fancy genes and are more fun, even though they don't want to stick around. How can she shut off that drive in herself? How can she force herself to choose the pair bond, less good-looking guy, so that she gets the guy that will stick around and have a kid? Have you ever seen any females overcome this and succeed?
Oh my God. This is how many times have I watched this movie? Okay. The so if she's mid 30s, she's conveniently got her head in the sand, and she may have to burn a few more eggs before she comes to the party. Usually they wake up in a cold sweat at 38 and they're out of time. Okay, so that's what we're observing here. So all I could tell her is, you know, it's time to play my favorite game, which is 10 paid dates. You know, that's what you got to do. And if you don't want to do it, no problem. Nobody cares. This isn't a moralistic thing. Nobody's telling you the right way to live. You can. It sounds like she's enjoying her existence just fine. However, she has other agendas, and the nature of life is that our agendas are inherently in conflict. Okay, so we don't have a seamless integration of motivation where a whole bunch of things that we want to do are all seamlessly integrated with each other in a beautiful, benign balance, and we don't have any conflict. Your brain is inherently in conflict all the time. You always have alternative courses of action that the mind is grinding away and thinking that alternative course of action may be better than the course of action than the one that you're taking. And so this is the nature of life. So she is following her a Stone Age agenda, and this is, it all feels pretty well right to her, and there is nothing in principle wrong with it, other than that if she wants a modern, you know, if she wants to pull off a modern coup of the modern female, which is to have a male that sticks around indefinitely and wants to be there, then that's unlikely to be somebody that's the fanciest guy that you can get in the bar, okay? So the sexiest guy in the bar. So it's exceedingly unlikely to be that guy. So there's trade-offs. And so what she might want to do is, I don't know how much heartache she has at the end of these things. Maybe not a lot. All depends upon how sort of open to experience she is and so on. But if she does, if she's got any significant amount of heartache and is feeling, she's feeling the grim reaper of age 40 sort of out there wavering, you know, in the distance, then it's time to play 10 paid dates is what it is. And it's time to, you know, that's what I would tell somebody to do. And I'd say, hey, listen, experiment with it. See what it feels like to dodge bullet when he makes an aggressive move on date three. You shut him down pleasantly, and then he doesn't call you back. See what that feels like, okay? And then he calls you back a month later. Hey, babe, you know, gonna now put in 2 cents a little later just to see whether or not he can get back in. Try playing that and see what it feels like to let one go. And if it turns out that you feel like you dodged a mess, then you'll feel like I feel when I'm almost goaded into a fight with somebody. Okay. When I'm almost goaded into an argument with a heckler, and I do the right thing instead of the instinctive thing. And the instinctive thing is to cave in their skull. And the right thing is to flatter them and give them, pat them on the head and give the little narcissist some nice feedback, and then they're my friend, and then we don't have a problem. And then I don't have to have that rattling around in my brain for the next 4 days about how I teed off on somebody and, of course, crushed them, because believe me, I will, okay? It's like I'm not going to come away without the victory, but I come away
with... Dr.
Byron,
we love when you do that, by the way.
It's just so bad. It's just so self-indulgent, okay? But when I do that, whenever I do that, which it's down to usually, you know, less than once or twice a year these days, but whenever I do that, you know, I pay the price for 4 days. So I have way too much baggage in my head. And in the same way, if some girl has got baggage that she reverberates behind, two paid dates in a dump, 3 weeks later, then it was fun while it lasted, but gee, I'm disappointed and I'm lonely and I'm frustrated, and when is this ever going to end? It's time to play a new strategy. And that's what I would tell this person to do.
Now, I've often thought that, you know, I understand the pleasure trap when it comes to food, mm-hmm. because there's unnatural foods in the environment. I understand it when it comes to pornography. But as far as casual mating, I know it's not, I always suspect if it's some sort of pleasure trap, because nowadays there's access to so much more casual mating than there ever was in the Stone Age. And I can't
right.
help but think if there's some sort of unnatural process there that makes it difficult for people to escape.
That's a good observation. I'm not sure about this, but I would say that there is I would say that the following is true. I would say that people that are on the attractive side of the scale, for them, remember that as you get in the upper reaches, say in the upper 20 percentile of the distribution, you're getting a situation where people that are quite attractive can find people that they find very attractive often, will find them acceptable. That's not going to be true in the middle of the distribution, okay? So in the middle of the distribution, a five is, you know, fives have their eyes. We now know scientifically where they've got their eyes set. They've got them set at least at the 75th percentile, okay? So I never knew what those numbers were, and I feel very fortunate, you know, to live in a world where a lot of these questions are being answered quantitatively. Because I knew that this was the dynamic, but I didn't know the extent of it, and it's actually worse than I thought. So so as a result, you can imagine if let's suppose you're an 8.5, whereas an 8.5, there's no such thing as setting your sights at 25 percentile higher. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. There isn't 25 percentile higher. So as a result, you're in a situation where you're very often in circumstances where people that are damn attractive to you might find you attractive. If you're a five, you're almost never in that situation. And so if you're an 8.5, or let's just for fun, quit call it an 8.5, let's call it a 9. Okay. So that's a lot of people. So, if you're a 9, you're in situations happening constantly where you're running into people that are superficially reasonable in terms of their personalities and their personality cues that they give off, and you find them physically appealing and they find you physically appealing, okay? That's a formula for casual mating. And so not a lot of the food chain winds up there. Now we're going to add something else to it, alcohol, okay? So now we're going to add normal care and concern for females guarding their eggs, and we're going to reduce that. Okay? So now that's interesting. We've now altered the brain and distorted its mechanisms. So now it's going to be essentially risky with its jewels. And so now we've contributed a major factor in making this far more likely. Okay? You can think about, I want you to think, Nate, about if you had the same situation exactly that you have today, except there was no such thing as alcohol. There was no drugs, no alcohol. Now what would it look like? Okay? I think that we can agree that a huge percentage of casual mating processes mm-hmm. would be reduced substantially. All right? Mm-hmm. So that I don't think that that's a trivial issue. All right? So, well, now what do I think? So now if you say, okay, it might seem to us that the casual mating is a fairly rampant, fairly, you know, pleasure trap, a little bit distorted look at the world. But let's take away two things out of the equation. We're going to completely wipe out the top 20% of humanity out of the equation and all the alcohol. Okay? If we do that, how much casual mating action do we really have? And I think the answer is probably not a lot. Okay? So
got
I
it.
Think
okay.
that,
yeah.
does that make sense?
Yeah, that
yeah.
makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Yeah. So I think
right.
that, I think those two factors alone probably account for a lot of what it is that you're seeing that looks like a distorted view of what humanity ought to look like. And it is a distorted view. Because I think those two features give rise to The motivation for pursuing casual mating strategy, you can imagine the spectacular difference in motivation if you're a 9, male or female, but suppose you're a 9 male, okay, with good social skills and nothing bizarre about you personality-wise. You're not, you know, living with your mother in the back of her house because you can't get a job, okay? You're actually a competent human. You have good social skills, and you're a 9. Let's think about this. And you're comfortable with alcohol in a scene that involves, you know, people drinking and dancing and so on. If you look at that situation, your perceived probability of success is extremely high. Okay, so as a result of that, you're motivated to look for those circumstances in order to execute on casual mating strategy. So therefore, you know, a fair amount of reasonable amount of time and energy is going to go into pursuing that which is clearly quite a novel evolutionary situation. Oh, I forgot one other thing that I meant to mention, which is that birth control, you know, has arrived on the scene since, you know, 1970 in a way that's reasonably convenient. So when you add birth control, high attractiveness, alcohol, all in one swirling cauldron, you get a situation where we're going to get, you know, a pretty intensive amount of casual mating strategy in a subset of the population. Okay.
Fascinating. No, that perspective makes a lot more sense than what was floating around in my head.
Got it. Okay.
So now we turn to a different potential pleasure trap, which is masturbation.
Yeah,
and the question from our listener is, Dr. Lyle, does masturbation make somebody lazy, sort of tricking their brain into believing that they got laid and they're therefore relatively successful? This listener says, I realize that such an effect may have been quickly weeded out in the Stone Age, but I'm wondering if the supernormal stimulus of modern porn is different. When did Stone Age people even masturbate?
Boy, you know, this is a very interesting question, and I would say that I don't know the answers to a lot of these questions. Now, my understanding is that that for male masturbation, I understand that this has to do with the general. This is essentially straight homeostatic drive theory, that there's cyclical processes and homeostatic processes involved in you know, survival and reproduction. So whether it's breathing or whether it's temperature regulation or whether it's hunger, whether it's thirst, whether it's sleep, whether it's physical rest from exertion or whether it's masturbation, that I believe that the biological purpose of that drive for orgasm is going to be to clear out essentially aged sperm and to make it so that any sperm that hit a female are more likely to be vigorous. Now, that's something that I read quite a long time ago, and I don't know where. This just feels like I read it. This has David Buss's stamp on it, but that's my memory of that. Now, I never, probably because I'm a male, and I was probably relieved there was a very high and mighty reason for this. However, I don't recall that I remembered anything analogous in the female arena. And I also remember, I believe, that if my memory serves me correctly, I believe that only 50% of females masturbate, and which is quite interesting. I believe probably male percentages are higher, and it makes sense that they would be higher based on this biological process. So I'm a little now as to the other questions. So number one, I do not understand female masturbation. I don't understand if there's a physiological advantage, what it is, and whether or not any drive therein is anything other than an artifact of the fact that orgasms are not only beneficial for grabbing the sperm backflow of an attractive male, So in other words, the female is more likely to be orgasmic if they find the male sexy. And they're more likely to find the male sexy if he has better genes. In other words, if he's more physically attractive, if he has facial features that indicate high levels of testosterone, as well as obviously then if his sperm actually are more motile. So the female orgasm is not random. That doesn't mean with great technique, some of us might not be able to compete. But the bottom line is that sheer sexy delta for the female feeling like the guy is fancy relative to her is a useful thing to cause female orgasms, which are therefore increasing the statistical likelihood of pregnancies. So we know that the female orgasm is definitely biologically useful as something akin to a Mr. Right detector. However, what that would have to do with female masturbation is mysterious to me at this point, and I don't know, maybe somebody knows, but I don't know. Okay. Now, as we move on to the issue of could masturbation in a modern environment with pornography make people lazy, I don't think it's tricking the brain into thinking that you're successful any more than it would have been tricking the brain in the Stone Age into thinking that you were successful. So I don't think that's true. I think that any supernormal stimuli at all can result in addictive-like processes any supernormal stimuli by definition is going to potentially move a person's life out of balance relative to where it was before. And the supernormal stimuli could move their lives out of balance in a direction that is not entirely benign. Okay? So I have no, in other words, that the overall balance of their life winds up not being as good as it would be without the supernormal stimulus. Now, that's not true of all supernormal stimuli. So, for example, movies and comedy or television can be, these are all supernormal stimuli. So, you know, when you watch a movie, you're watching a story written by very smart writers, generally. They did the best they could after the director hacked it up. Okay, but the point is that you've got actors, beautiful faces, you know, you have music, for goodness sake, by professional musicians. You've got a supernormal stimuli, and it puts your, you know, it puts your life for the hours that you're watching it into a reverie that can be a magnificent experience, and it's a supernormal process. And yet we wouldn't say, oh, well, that's a terrible thing. That's a supernormal stimuli, and therefore this is wrecking your life, okay? Music, we can get closer and say, wait a second. You know, music is marvelous and can be a beautiful addition. It's definitely supernormal. But we can see situations where it looks like it's got a hold of somebody's nervous system and it's pounding the daylights out of it. Okay, so we can see that there are occasions where it looks like music, yeah, by virtue of its supernormal quality, can actually disturb someone's life processes to the point where it's not ideal. Okay, some teenager that's in the garage blasting their head, you know, with 120 decibel music, this is a life out of balance, and they may well have essentially an addictive process. It's a problem. Okay, now. In other words, not generally very benign supernormal stimuli. Food, we can see, we know there are problems with the supernormal stimuli of food. Drugs, definitely, okay? Pornography, for some people, it's just, this would be, I would say that this is the equivalent of wine. You know, Alan would wrinkle up his nose, Dr. Alan Goldhammer would wrinkle up his nose, the mere mention of Chardonnay. Yeah, I mean, but the truth of the matter is that if we're not being stuffy about this, most people can use alcohol on occasion, and it's an addition to their life, and it's not a problem. For 5% of people, it's a disaster, okay? And I would probably also say that something akin to this is going to be true with pornography, with potentially music. I can't think of other supernormal stimuli at the moment. I could. Television. Okay, so there's people that are sufficiently entertained by television that they could sit there and watch unbelievably insipid things for hours, and we can look at this and really say, you know what, this is a problem. Okay, is it destroying your life? No. But is your life impoverished and actually not as good a life as it would be because we are feeding you with a supernormal stimuli that's just tickling the circuits into thinking that this is productive activity? Yeah. Okay, and you'd be better off shutting it down. And so so I think that that's where I would that's where I believe that's going to be. And certainly I have treated people in my career that were addicted to pornography. Not common, but it's been there, you know, and for a few people, it's a real problem.
Mm-hmm. And something like video games, where I've always assumed that video games can be particularly addictive because the person playing the video games gets immediate feedback if they do something right in the game. And if they don't, they die and they have to start all over again, which is kind of similar to life, but it happens so much more efficiently with the video game that it can probably be more pleasing.
There's no question. I think video games is a fantastic example of a modern supernormal stimuli. And once again, as we look through that lens, we're looking at something that is not heroin, you know what I'm saying? It's not cigarettes. It's but it's got a porn-like quality to it. And the in other words, it can be very compelling. And certain nervous systems, you know, can't leave it alone. And it can swallow up their existence. And I'm not going to say that these things lead to terrible lives, but what I'm going to say is that they lead to lives that are out of balance, and that the person is essentially now not actually having probably as satisfying an existence as would be possible for that nervous system. And the laziness that this person refers to is involved here in the same way with the video games. These are shortcuts to the feeling of productive action. And in the same way that pornography is shortcuts to the feeling that one has obtained a very, very fancy mate and it is, you know, and this has been accomplished. And therefore, you know, there's a feeling of productive reproductive action. So I think that, you know, I'm not sanctimonious or Methodist or anything else about any of this kind of thing. I look at each of these things, including processed food, including wine, including pornography, all of it. I look at it with an eye of mild concern. Until I look at an evidence of a specific individual where it's more than a mild concern, where I see that it's grabbed a hold of their motivational system and it's twisted their life into significant imbalance. And that's, can that happen? Absolutely.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lai, well, speaking of pleasure traps, now it's Halloween, and I guess people are going to go out trick-or-treating or partying or whatever we're supposed to do on Halloween night. I might end up giving out, you know, chocolate-covered Brussels sprouts or broccoli or something like that. I can fully expect my house to get egged tonight.
You got it.
All right, Dr. Lyle, have a great night, and we'll speak to you next week.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.